Welcome to Thelema Now, a podcast about Aleister Crowley, ritual, the arts, and magic. The show today is actually a rebroadcast of a panel that was done at this year's South by Southwest Music Conference held in Austin, Texas. The panel was titled Blood, Music, Sex Magic, and the description is as follows. Rock musicians have been denounced for their apparently magical impact that they have on their audience, often reciting lyrics replete with mystical references and officiating over public rites that can appear downright sorcerous to outsiders. Is all this merely theater? Voodoo rhythms shaped New Orleans R&B and rock and roll. Immersive, multimedia rituals are now practiced as concert spectacle by everyone from U2 to the Black Eyed Peas. This panel seeks to examine the occult philosophies that found their way into the lyrics of Chuck Berry, the Beatles, Led Zeppelin, and so on. This panel also discusses the collaborations between various rock stars and prominent magicians like Kenneth Anger and Harry Smith. The guests on this panel are former OTO body master Joshua Sharp, musician Andrew W.K., author Allison Fensterstock, as well as academic Eric Davis. We now go to the panel, which was recorded in March of 2012.
Welcome to the Blood, Music, Sex Magic panel. The purpose of this panel is looking at the fact that rock and R&B performers have been rumored to have satanic affiliations and exercising occult influence over their fans, from Jay-Z to Tool. And indeed, mystical-themed lyrics appear in many songs, and mystical themes appear in album artworks from Screamin' Jay Hawkins to the Beatles. Concert productions regularly have the appearance of dark religious rituals and do alter the audience's consciousness. Now, if you thought about all this, you're likely to have wondered whether this was all lip service or hipster window dressing, or is there some serious magical work being practiced here? And how would this have entered into pop music consciousness in the first place? How pervasive has it been, and is it still happening now? So, I'd like to introduce our panelists. Now, from his website, it says Andrew W.K. is the king of partying. Infamous for his bloody nose, famous for his high life attitude, remembered for his songs like Party Hard, We Want Fun, and You Will Remember Tonight. Andrew's true will is to use all forms of entertainment to create feelings of pure joy, fun, love, freedom, and possibility. He is a multifaceted musician and performer, starting his musical career at age 4 with classical piano lessons, then exploring experimental and fine art interests. Andrew went on to create his own brand of extremely high-energy rock and roll. Andrew grew up in the open-minded Midwestern city of Ann Arbor at age 18 after being accepted into the Art Institute of Chicago. Andrew decided instead to move to New York City and pursue art and music on his own. He released his first album, I Get Wet, in 2011, and has been busy recording, touring, lecturing, making television appearances, producing other artists, and the like ever since. On my far right, we have Eric Davis, who has been writing about the intersection of popular culture, media, technology, and alternative religion for over 20 years. He has written a number of books, including the 33 and a third book on Led Zeppelin IV and the more recent Nomad Codes, Adventures in Modern Esoterica. He hosts the popular podcast Expanding Mind, and is currently earning his PhD in religious studies at Rice University. To my left again, Allison Fensterstock is a New Orleans-based music and pop culture writer. Her work has appeared in Paste, Vibe, Spin.com, Mojo, Q, The Oxford American, The New Orleans Alt Weekly Gambit, and The New Orleans Times-Picayune, where she blogs on a regular basis. In 2011, she co-wrote the book The Definition of Bounce with rapper 10th Ward Buck. She was the bounce consultant for season two of HBO's dramatic program, Treme, and co-curated the Bounce and Hip-Hop Documentary Exhibition and Oral History Archive, Where They At, with photographer Aubrey Edwards. She is also the programming director for the Ponderosa Stomp Foundation, for whom she researched the Louisiana State Museum's Unsung Heroes exhibit on Louisiana R&B, rock, garage, and blues. And last but not least, to my immediate right, Joshua Sharp was the founding member master of Alambrados Oasis, the New Orleans-based body of the Ordo Templi Orientis, a Thelemic initiatory fraternity. He has been an initiate of this order since 2002 and has an avid interest in Thelema, the discipline of magic, and the method of scientific illuminism since 1999. He's also been an aspirant to the AA since 2008 and continues to prosecute this great work. Josh is a graduate of the University of New Orleans and holds a continuing interest in neuropsychology, philosophy, and the sciences in general. He holds a strong interest in the intersection between ritual and music. He continues to explore both of these as sources for inspiration and as techniques for producing the ecstasy of transcendence. So I'd like to start by asking Josh, what is magic and what is it that a modern magician actually does?
Well, I'd like to open with a quote from Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, spoken through the mouth of Faust. What you don't feel, you will not grasp by art unless it wells out of your soul. And with sheer pleasure takes control, compelling every listener's heart. This quote, spoken from the mouth of the archetypal magician, Faust, describes the quest to have one's own soul speak, and with it powerfully enchant the world. This same sentiment could have come from any number of painters, sculptors, or musicians, and indeed it often did. In fact, the painter Paul Gauguin's artistic sentiments are so resonant with magic that it led the arch-magician, Aleister Crowley, to say of Gauguin, "Gauguin literally torments me. I feel as if by my own choice of exile, rather than the toleration of the bourgeois, I am invoking him. And this painting of my house seems a sort of religious magical rite, like the Egyptian embalmers, but of necromancy. I would that he might come forth his pleasure on the earth to do amongst the living." One of the most famous paintings by Gauguin is titled, "Where Do We Come From? What Are We? Where Are We Going?" I think this title aptly captures much of the initial questions which a magician aims to answer. It is, however, one thing to desire this knowledge and an altogether different thing to achieve it. Here I find myself brought back to the discipline of magic. What is it? Sir James George Frazer, writing on the subject of magic, states in his seminal work, The Golden Bough, "So far, therefore, as the public profession of magic has been one of the roads by which the ablest men have passed to supreme power, it has contributed to emancipate mankind from the thraldom of tradition and to elevate them into a larger, freer life with a broader outlook on the world. This is no small service rendered to humanity. And we remember that in another direction, magic has paved the way for science. We are forced to admit that if the black art has done much evil, it has also been the source of much good. That if it is the child of error, it has yet been the mother of freedom and truth." This same quote is found in the beginning of Aleister Crowley's Magic and Theory and Practice, where he introduces the term magic, restored to its medieval spelling with a K, and differentiates it from common conjuring acts, sleight of hand, or mere sorcery. Crowley, struggling with the proper term by which he might describe his system of liberation, declares, "I chose, therefore, the name magic as essentially the most sublime and actually the most discredited of all the available terms. I swore to rehabilitate magic, to identify it with my own career, and to command mankind to respect, love, and trust, that which they scorned, hated, and feared. We may then ask pointedly, what is magic? What is a magical act? For Crowley, as stated in Magic in Theory and Practice, every intentional act is a magical act. Here, however, he specifies by intentional that he means willed. Without going into a lengthy discussion of what exactly Crowley means when he uses technical terms like will, I think I can say that he intends acts which proceed from an individual without overt compulsion from simple personal habit, clime, or society. As you can imagine, this is no easy task. This leads him to say, every man and every woman has a course, depending partly on the self and partly on the environment which is natural and necessary for each. Anyone who is forced from his own course, either through not understanding himself or through external opposition, comes into conflict with the order of the universe and suffers accordingly. A man whose conscious will is at odds with his true will is wasting his strength. He cannot hope to influence his environment efficiently. What is the nature of this true will? What is it capable of? Crowley writes that man is ignorant of the nature of his own being and powers. Even his idea of his limitations is based on experience of the past, and every step in his progress extends his empire. There is therefore no reason to assign theoretical limits. Perhaps the most simple and direct definition of magic that he ever penned was that magic is the science of understanding oneself and the art of applying that understanding in action. To this end, Crowley, taking from magical and religious traditions that span the globe, working in concert with other magicians, scientists, artists, musicians, yogis, and the like, founded a definite system of magic to accomplish these ends. This system can be openly studied and practiced by anyone, and many probably do so unconsciously, achieving the same ends through different but similar means. I wish to share this specific system with you, in its practices I have seen it, because it has been such an enormous influence on the musicians and artists of today. Many of these musicians simply parrot what they see in the image and the myth and the allure. I am unconvinced, for example, that Ozzy Osbourne is an adept in any traditional religious sense. However, there are countless musicians and artists who have put this discipline into practice and demonstrate these fruits for themselves. The medieval magician may have had a wand, while the modern magician wields a brush, a pen, or a guitar. The medieval magician had his prayers of invocations sung in strange intonations. Many of our modern magicians will chant with song. These ecstatic expressions of magical force, that is, the force emanating from the true will of an individual, can utilize any form and any device proper to its nature. For many, this will be music. Music becomes the expression of our magic and the tool by which we practice magic. How might one approach this system of magic? What are the things that magicians do? For me, it was to first garner some knowledge of most systems of attainment. What had the great magicians and sages of old said on the subject? I read through the Raja Yoga of Swami Vivekananda, the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, the Shiva Samhita, the writings of Patanjali and other yogic fundamentals. After all these, were the types of individuals who had claimed mastery over the mind and the senses, to have reached further into the mysterious power of the self than most thought possible. I looked into the spiritual writings of the Christian quietists, such as Miguel Molinos, and other mystics such as St. John of the Cross. I studied the writings of Lao Tzu and Kuan Tzu. I studied the Hebrew Kabbalah, the Western and Hermetic Kabbalah. I studied the holy angelic systems of Abramelin the Mage, the occult philosophy of Heinrich Cornelius Agrippa von Nettensheim, the medieval grimoires and theurgic records from the Greek magical papyri to demonic summoning textbooks like the Guisha. I looked into the collective works of Aleister Crowley, the enormous magical tome that is the Equinox, and many others. All in all, my task was not to agree with everything that these men had to say, but to see if there was not some similar claim or some harmony in behavior or quest within their records. I hope to find some starting point for this adventure, to develop a map, distorted by time and culture as it may be, but a map by which I could navigate the nature and powers of my own being. Crowley once asked, what is there in common between Christ, Buddha, and Muhammad? To this he answered, an omission. After discussing their various circumstances, he concludes, a nobody goes away and comes back a somebody. He further notes, the methods advised by all people have a startling resemblance to one another. They recommend virtue, solitude, absence of excitement, moderation in diet, and finally a practice which some call prayer and some call meditation. After a lengthy dissertation on these methods and their similarity to the traditional medieval practice of magic, he puts forth the basis for his own system. This system is a synthesis of the many studies I spoke of above. It is a distillation to those essentials. When I began, I swore a magical oath to obtain a scientific knowledge of the nature and powers of my own being. I then set to experiment, applying the traditional practices and observances of a magical aspirant and noting the conditions and the results in my journal. Ultimately, what I found astonished me. What may have started as a type of self-help or a type of mind hacking quickly led itself into unabashedly magical experiences, the kind of which are the stuff of Hollywood. It is important to note that at least in Crowley's system of magic, one is not to immediately accept the results of extraordinary experiences as genuine, but to simply record them and formulate correlations between acts and phenomena. With this understanding, I took a kind of tour about the magical practices and records of many medieval magicians. I began working with the angelic system of Dr. John Dee, the court astrologer to Queen Elizabeth I. I would fashion the required mirrors and talismans, tables, and vestments. I would harvest various plants for incense and practice the meditational techniques which were claimed prerequisite for visions. I did the same with the various forms of so-called demonic magic and witchcraft. I tried my best to treat this as a discipline, following out the insane quest of these grimoires, practicing the daily meditations, the prayers, invocations, and the like. All in all, I spent at minimum an hour or two a day for at least a year doing this kind of experiment, and it would not have been uncommon to find me in the necromancer's circle attempting summoning for 6 to 12 hours at a time, or on another day find me practicing the breathing techniques of yoga. All in all, what I discovered was not what I expected. I now hold a hunch that much of these practices touch a reality which I find it hard to accept, but I nevertheless seem to have encountered. This is certainly not a proposition I expect anyone listening to accord with on faith. You have to go there yourself. However, aside from the metaphysics of magic, it also seems to function as a magnificent mirror into the soul. It lays out the content of one's unconscious and displays them in an all too real form, both beautiful and terrifying. Were there no mysterious preternatural forces in the universe, I believe these practices still have immense psychological potential when treated in the proper manner. Anyone who's read Salvador Dali's 50 Secrets of Magic Craftsmanship can tap into this sort of artistic magic. In these cases, magic is a dance with the psyche. I would advance the idea that magic is, in any case, always a dance with the psyche. And for some, this dance will lead to hereto unsuspected realms. For those of you who would take up this path, you will eat both of the fruit of the tree of knowledge, and to complete it, you must take forth your hands and, becoming as one of them, eat of the fruit of the tree of life.
Thank you, Josh. So now having an idea of what the pursuit of magic might mean in the 21st century, turn to Allison to ask, what sort of influence did the magical and religious practices indigenous to New Orleans have on the secular musics that have emerged from that city over the decades, because certainly the impact of New Orleans-based music on the formation of jazz, rock and roll, R&B is prodigious. And it really, to a large degree, starts there.
Well, yeah, I think lots of people agree, and I definitely do because I live in New Orleans, that almost all American popular music is pretty much rooted there, and to see why. But yeah, so to see why most American popular music, hip-hop, jazz, funk, R&B, rock and roll, why that all comes from New Orleans, you have to go back about 300 years to Congo Square in the early 18th century. That was a part of town where, unlike almost any southern cities, slave owners would allow slaves to gather there and sing the songs they had brought over from Africa, Cuba, and Haiti, and play the instruments they had brought and do religious rituals. So there is kind of an element of, was it magic or was it not? Because, you know, you do have these, all of these people did not come to the New World on purpose. So the people that brought them there and are keeping them as property were nervous about the sounds of drums and chants and other languages coming out of the park and getting a little bit freaked out about it when it pretty much just is non-Western religion. And the same way those, you know, polyrhythms and melodies eventually sort of combined with European instrumentation and European music, so did the religion. It got mixed with Catholicism, sort of American household magic, and became what we kind of know as New Orleans voodoo and American voodoo. So that's where you kind of have the basis of the music. And as it evolved, you know, with those African, Cuban, Haitian drum beats combining with trumpets and trombones from Europe, you sort of get New Orleans brass music, Mardi Gras Indian traditions, jazz, rock and roll, hip hop. Sorry, I'm checking my handwriting that I can't totally read. But yeah, so I would say that what the music that they were doing as part of ritual was religious and in a way magical. So even if most of the music that came from it is not necessarily consciously magical, it is all rooted in that. And one of the things that I think is the most interesting about New Orleans music as it stands today is so much of the music that we consider, you know, the root music of New Orleans. And you're talking about brass bands doing second lines, Mardi Gras Indians doing chants and parades, and even bounce music, which is a call and response dance music. They all kind of follow the pattern of ritual. Like they all require participation. It's music to be consumed live and while you're dancing, or even while you're kind of saying your part back. You know, you can't really have a bounce concert with a rapper who's sort of yelling stuff out, and then you can't not say something back. The show doesn't work. So in a way, you could argue when that's happening, the ritual isn't working. You know, the effect isn't happening. You're not getting the result of what is essentially a magical or religious experience from that. So sort of beyond that, then there is also the element of the imagery and the smoke and mirrors of voodoo that's turned up in New Orleans music over time. You definitely have the Dr. John Night Tripper phenomenon, although that did kind of come from an interest that he had in voodoo in the late 50s, which was shared by a lot of other musicians. Jesse Hill, who did the song Oopoopadoo, was sort of a dabbler in magic. Earl King, the rhythm and blues guitarist, was actually first managed and booked by a voodoo man. Apparently, he was playing guitar on the street with a bunch of other kids, and guy came up and said, if you want some shows, you know, you should come by my house. He went by the guy's house, and he was booking music out of there, but he was also selling herbs, potions, and spells. So you sort of got all those elements in a one-stop shop. You know, you could get your R&B band, and you could get your Love Spell and your St. John the Conqueror route, and it's, you know, what more could you ask for? Also, Jelly Roll Morton, famously, his godmother who raised him was the predominant voodoo lady of the Storyville area. So she would be going around to all the prostitutes and the madams and providing them with their red brick dust and their get money spells and their love root. And he would sort of follow her around, get to know them, and eventually get work playing music. So there is this sort of combination of voodoo culture and musical culture, which I think I explained earlier is kind of like, it's not necessarily religious or active magical practice all the time, but it's similar to, if you live in New York, even if you're not Jewish, you know some Yiddish. Like, if you live in New Orleans and you're in the creative, artistic, musical world, that's the elements of voodoo just kind of slip into your whole culture. What else? I know I had more examples of voodoo people. Oh, actually, the Dr. John character was not even initially intended for Dr. John. There was sort of this general interest in the imagery of voodoo and the actual practice of voodoo among a lot of the R&B musicians that he was contemporary with. And the AFO label, which was formed in 1961 by Harold Batiste, it was the first black-owned label in New Orleans. They had wanted to create this character that was kind of a, you know, scarf-wearing, spangled, spooky voodoo man, you know, which would have worked with the, like, African-Cuban rhythms that were part of R&B at the time. And they started to do it with a character named Lawrence Nelson. He was the brother of Fats Domino's first guitar player, Papoose Nelson. And they called him Prince Lala, and they took a lot of publicity shots of him, and he was wearing a head wrap, and he had earrings and a scarf, and he was all voodoo-y. And then he died pretty quickly after they started, so that didn't work. But Dr. John had been working with the AFO label with a guy named Ronnie Barron, who had done a lot of his earlier rock and roll stuff with him back when he was first playing guitar. So they said, well, we're interested in this voodoo character. We're going to call him Dr. John, which was also the name of a iconic New Orleans voodoo guy, sort of on the same level as Marie Laveau. He was kind of a pre-Civil War Haitian transplant to New Orleans who was a pretty famous voodoo priest. And they said, we're going to call this character Dr. John. We're going to dress him up. We're going to do this spooky, psychedelic voodoo thing with him, because we're, by this point, we're kind of in the mid-60s, and that's all kind of starting to happen. And Ronnie Barron wasn't able to do it because he was under contract to another label, so Mac Rebinac said, well, like, I'm not going to imitate his voice because I can't, but he's like, I guess I'll do it. I'll be that dude. And there we have Dr. John. And, you know, he was interested in the psychedelic culture and the drug culture, and he was going out to California a lot. So there was part of that just kind of hippie mysticism and magic to it. But there was also his genuine experience on the streets of New Orleans with real practical magic practitioners. And he would bring in people like a character called the Chicken Man, who was a sort of famous voodoo guy on the streets up through, I think he died in the late 90s, but he would bring real voodoo practitioners on stage to his shows, kind of during the Gree-Gree and Sun, Moon, and Herbs era. So it was a combination of, like, showmanship and actual street voodoo culture, which, I mean, I guess is that, you know, beyond the basic influence of the music and the polyrhythms that come from the countries where voodoo was started, then in New Orleans after that, you just have this kind of pervasive, magical element that winds its way through almost everything. And then it does seem to have an attraction. Maybe these are just the people I meet. New Orleans still does have an attraction for musicians who are interested in non-Western, mystical, magical traditions. At the end of his life, Earl King used to set up shop in a Tasty Donut store on Britannia Street, and he would sit there all day with his legal pads, sort of doing astrological and numerological charts, and talking to anyone who came around sort of about his superstitions and his religious concepts and his personal mystical theories. Jerry Hall, who was one of the singers in Huey Piano Smith and the Clowns, is sort of a big astrology person and also does a lot of spell casting on her own. And actually Alex Chilton, who spent, you know, the last, pretty much the entire second half of his life in New Orleans, was incredibly devoted to astrology and spent some time with Earl King too, and would, you know, do people's charts and sort of do research into your birth date and what that meant and your the numerology elements. And so it's just, it seems like it's sort of continuing to be a little bit of a part of musical culture in New Orleans still today at whatever level.
Cool. Two things real quick. Number one, for people who don't know, Earl King, probably best known outside of New Orleans for having written Big Chief, which was a big hit for Professor Longhair. Or maybe that means nothing to anyone either. But look it up someday. Look it up, Big Chief. Pretty amazing song. And going back to how this, say, Dr. John's creation of the Dr. John character, Mac Rabinac's invention of the Dr. John character, was in part sort of very much in tune with the sort of, I guess what we would call now hippie mysticism, I would like to turn the floor over to Eric and ask, how has the occult influenced mainstream rock and roll history overall?
All right. Thanks. Thanks for that question. I think I'll pick up. You'll notice that a number of times Allison talked about this place where we, as we're trying to narrate this story, say, like, well, there was some real stuff over here, and there was some showmanship over here, or there was some, you know, actual voodoo rhythms or gods over here, and over here we have some smoke and mirrors, or we have some characters that are constructed for record companies, et cetera, et cetera. And it's kind of hard to tell what's going on there. And the first message is that ambiguity, is it real or is it Memorex, is fundamental to the way that the occult works. So it's you figure out the answer to the question of what influence the occult had on music by going into that ambiguity, not by saying, oh, it's just a bunch of sham things that are sold to kids who want to, you know, feel like there's something special, or these guys are all, you know, selling their souls, or they're all magical adepts with, you know, enormous libraries and the kinds of disciplinary commitments that Joshua was talking about. So one way of thinking about this is, like, how do you think about the occult? Like, if you think about the Christianity, it's really easy to tell the history of Christianity. They have the church there. It's been there for 200 years. They have all these books. The pastor today, he went to the seminary. You know, you can chart that stuff. It's in the library. Everybody knows it. But how do you chart the history of the occult or the history of African religion in the New World? But much more difficult, because it comes and goes. It appears, it congeals, it gets repressed, it gets broken apart, it gets forgotten, it gets remembered, it gets reconstructed. And so historians of religion refer to these things often as currents, like esoteric or occult currents. Like currents, they go underground, and they come up above ground again. And it's, again, thinking that ambiguity above and below is really key to this question of, like, what's going on with rock and roll from the late 60s through the 70s, which was also the time of the massive occult revival with the republishing of a huge amount of occult material, the beginnings of, or intensifications of, a lot of spiritual practices that had existed for previous decades but really took off in a new way with neo-paganism and witchcraft orders and magical orders and all sorts of craziness that was going on, you know, particularly in the 1970s. So you ask, like, you have to keep that ambiguity in mind. So for an example we talked about earlier, there was a period where Mick Jagger was really good friends with Kenneth Anger, who was an Angelino filmmaker who was deeply, deeply into Aleister Crowley and Thelema at a time when not many people were. And he had a very rare collection of texts. He was a very serious practitioner, and it's in his films. You know, you see these films, you're getting a download, you're tasting the current. And in the 1969 tour, Mick Jagger would often wear this top hat, this kind of Baron Samedi black top hat, and he's wearing it in Altamont. And he picked that up from an actor in one of Kenneth Anger's movies. Bobby Beausoleil goes on, and you know, Manson, it goes on and on and on. But anyway, Bobby Beausoleil would wear this hat, and that was part of one of his markers on the hate street. And he was a very magical character, a very occult figure that Anger recognized and kind of incultured. So you can see the way. Does it mean that it's magical for Mick Jagger or not? You know, maybe yes, maybe no. Hard to say not. But it does have an effect, because the current is there. Then you turn to somebody like Jimmy Page, who's
and it certainly worked at Altamont.
I can't have sympathy for that devil. But if you turn to someone like Jimmy Page, where it's much more clear, you know, Jimmy Page is, you know, in his interviews he would speak positively about Crowley and the meaningfulness of these practices. You know, he was clearly an enormous collector of his work. He got his, you know, the Boldskin Mansion. You know, it's very evident that even if he doesn't say exactly what his investment is very deep, and it goes beyond a kind of collectorness. But even there, there's this weird kind of ambiguity. A really good example is in The Song Remains the Same, when he's doing the violin solo, and there's a point where he'll stand up, and I'm just going to Joe it. He goes, boom, 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 boom. And he goes around, and he calls the quarters. You know, anybody who knows basic witchcraft will go, oh, he's just calling the quarters. Now, is he going, I am now using the power of the millions to call the quarters? Or is he going, I'm going to play with this sort of ritual gesture that I'm familiar with in other contexts, because it makes a certain sense here? You know, you can get paranoid about it, and which many Christians did, or you can sort of see again this blend, and in a way that the blend is the kind of occultism. So he's a really important figure. Another one we were talking about, of course, is David Bowie. In Hunky Dory, he's got explicit lyrics that gesture towards these esoteric currents, particularly the Golden Dawn, and he mentions Crowley's uniform of imagery. And in a sense, he's bringing that uniform of imagery forward, because part of the occult is the image. Like the magic, the inspiration, the sense of enchantment and wonder that can open up in ritual is also available in mere imagery. So someone might put an image on the record cover just to sell the record, but the image has something to say, at least to some of the audience. And so that's where you get into this kind of trickiness. Later in the 70s, Bowie, I kind of went over the top. When he was in L.A., he has a famous sort of like lost period where he gets totally into the Kabbalah, and he thinks these witches are after him, and he's like hiding in the pool. And, you know, he definitely goes over the edge. But some of that...
Looking to collect his sperm, right?
What's that?
Looking to collect his sperm.
And some of that Kabbalistic stuff is in Station to Station. You can read the lyrics in certain ways. And, of course, that's another way, is that how these lyrics encode experiences, inspirations, ideas, which may be picked up in a scattershot manner, or maybe real kind of welling up from either deep interior experience or deep study. And so it's always kind of ghosted by that. And we were saying earlier also that there's some evidence that Bowie was interested in the Ordo Templi Orientis, one of Crowley's Thelemite lodges or orders, into the 80s. So it's like his interests were clearly long. Now, but at the same time, that smoke and mirrors aspect, that kind of cheesy side, is, you know, it sort of undermines the story. Like Black Sabbath is very clear from the get-go. It's never more than a horror show. It's alcohol and horror movies and cool-looking crosses. That doesn't mean it's not powerful. It doesn't mean that kids don't have powerful experiences. But from their side, it's kind of a gimmick. And by the late 70s and in the early 80s, that stuff is just like going off, you know, out of hand, like with metal. The goofiness, the show tunes aspect of the occult, like in the Number of the Beast Iron Maiden video, if anybody remembers it, it's like they're actually like they have like horror movies, and then they have the Beast, and it's this whole like cartoon pop culture occultism that becomes kind of emptied of a real sense of threat, because those early Sabbath records are pretty scary records, and you don't have to be like an impressionable kid, and you put that thing on, you're like, ooh, wow, there's something going on there. So even if it's a gimmick for them, there's something there. But I think in the 80s, really what had to happen is that current, that real current, goes more underground. It becomes more experimental. And really the fountainhead here is Throbbing Gristle. Throbbing Gristle, super experimental, not explicitly occult in their attempts other than a radical exploration of human possibility,
well,
of sonic
outside
possibility.
Of their song, Searching for the OTO.
Yeah,
that's a bit blatant.
Yeah, I think that there are elements, but for them, at least for the way that I understand TG, that's just part of like they're going to look through everything. They're going to look at, you know, lounge culture. They're going to look at sex culture. They're just going to look, put it all together. And I think it becomes more intentional later. But you're right that it's there from the beginning. The seeds are there from the beginning. And then you have the Temple of Psychic Youth and later Coil as two groups. And in a way, they're going much further into how the conditions of making music and in disseminating music are themselves magical acts. So it's not just by saying, yeah, we're magicians, we're cool, we made this music, maybe you'll get something from it. It's like how the actual culture of the music making itself becomes a site of ritual. And particularly, I think, with Coil's music, for me, you can really, really hear it. You can really, really sense and know on some level that they are doing explorations in the recording, in the context of the recording, that becomes quite intense and quite powerful. And it's produced a very strong subculture, the kind of people who are into Coil. They overlap with these occult issues, even if they're also into other things. They created a genuine space within musical culture for a kind of intense and intelligent, engaged experience of occult practice and entheogenic practice as well, which are, of course, very intimately linked. And I think Current 93 is the other one we really have to mention from this period of in a very different way, certainly a more lyrical way, a more it's studied in a sense, more literary way in to some degree, talking about the same kinds of currents. But at this moment, I think it really had to be more underground because the surface level of pop occultism was so goofy that it didn't really mean anything to represent on that level. You know, Slayer, okay, maybe, sure, maybe not. But, you know, it's just kind of goofiness. So that kind of thing, I think, recurs in you know, there's a lot of other examples you can do. I think I'll probably have time for one more thing to talk about, which is black metal. And black metal is really interesting. Again, we were having an interesting conversation beforehand because it's like it's not clear again how studied they were, how intentional these early Norwegian acts like Mayhem. Were they sitting there with books going, oh, we're going to do a ritual now? Probably not. They were probably just extremely intense people who were pushing the boundaries and willingly invoking a certain kind of rhetoric of darkness as a way to channel their own feelings, their own sense of the world, et cetera, et cetera. But what I think is really interesting about this early moment in black metal, which is really fetishized, this kind of early old school black metal, is because it feels incredibly authentic. And that the authenticity becomes the magic that people are seeking for music because it becomes increasingly difficult to communicate. It looks more and more like music is concocted, that people are putting on a show, that they're kind of faking it, that they're ripping off somebody else. But there's something powerfully authentic about black metal, and it's very interesting when you line it up with gangster rap because they come about the same time. There's a period of a couple years where there are people making music that's intense, that's dark, that's kind of freaks people out on some level, but there's a quality of profound authenticity to it, which, you know, is a little constructed itself. But that sense of authenticity is more magical than any like record cover with a demon or, you know, like, oh, quotations from, you know, oh, your older brother had good books so you could steal some words or something. You know, that's not really where it's at. It's about a certain kind of authentic communication. And I'd say that in the last decade, for me, that has been that sense of authenticity has had to go into like the experiences of people in the concert. That it's less about the recording process, the packaging, the label, the words, like all that's going on, and some people are very authentic about it, and some people are just having a good time, no problem. But I think the real magic in the last 10, 15 years has really been in the experience of live music, you know, thinking about, you know, from psytrance, where you have intense psychedelic music that where people are very consciously, you know, manipulating their body minds in order to create an, a collective alternative, you know, dimension. To a lot of other, some of the underground occult music now is very, very ritualistic. It's almost like unless you're really doing it in a ritualistic context, in a way you can't avoid the circuit of commodities that ends up making it kind of inauthentic. So it's almost like a moving target, and it's never going to go away. And where it comes and where it goes is almost like a trickster's game. But that's the game. That's the game. It's like trying to, like, catch the trickster's smile and, you know, is the trick real or not? Is the trick real or not? But the question of whether the trick is real or not brings you further in to the labyrinth.
Thank you. So you mentioned Current 93, and of course Andrew does perform with Current 93 or has in the past.
Yes.
And you're also talking about the influence, well, the interface between making music and making magic, and I guess a good question is, you know, to what extent do the acts of creating art and doing magic overlap? What do you think, Andrew?
Well, first of all, I'm just so pleased to be here, and I've learned so much already from all that's being said. It's been very, very inspiring and thought-provoking, and has confirmed instincts or inklings or hints of instincts and inklings, or an inkling of an inkling that I've had. So I'm here to learn, and hopefully you guys have as well. Also, if you've never heard bounce music, it is one of the most exciting new kinds of music that I could ever recommend checking out, based on not just what Allison said, but from also what I've gotten to hear. It's you get a beep, 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 beep. It's just pure energy. And that's what I ultimately try to do and want to feel in life in general. There's an urge and an impulse that comes from somewhere deep inside or somewhere, you know, far beyond. People talk about these songs coming down to them and that they're channeling them. I understand that, but it also is something that's more personal than even your own self, where it's a melody or a feeling that a melody would get. You're trying to reach a state of joy, or at least that's what I get out of music, that you don't really get from anything else. And it's a very strange thing that music of all different sorts, whether it be like we're talking about black metal or bounce music or really old music or really new music or rock music, it's easy to get caught up in the instrumentation or the production style or the aesthetics and all that. But at the end, there should be some kind of very intense feeling. And even the most angry or dark or mean spirited music or violent music, it creates in me this feeling of joy, of pure joy, of being glad that I'm not dead so that I can feel this way. And when you follow that impulse through and actually use your body to make it happen, that to me is a real kind of magic that it doesn't take a lot to understand. And you can study it and refine it, but it doesn't get any more real than that. And any kind of joy that you find, whether it's through an image or an album cover or the sound of that recording or the just talking about it like this, it all counts. It's all real. It's all authentic. And I don't think it needs to be broken down much more than that unless you find, in fact, joy in breaking it down. That being said, I hope that everybody can look at this incredible convention itself, this festival, as an entire ritual, celebrating all the different ways that we're able to engage in this incredible thing, whether it's entertainment or performance or music or business. It all counts, and I don't think any of it really is bad or good. I think it's all just what you feel like doing yourself. And I've been so lucky to be able to make a lot of my own dreams come true in that regard. And coming here and seeing all the different dreams that other people have and how they're able to come true is, you know, motivating and inspiring on levels that are difficult to describe. But that's why we have these great drum beats and guitar riffs and everything else. And I think the black metal I've gotten to meet some of these folks that you're talking about, like with Mayhem, and they are the most fun-loving, nice mm-hmm. people you'd ever want to meet that have also gone through hardships and adversity, often self-created adversity that not only can I not fathom, but even wouldn't want to. It's all very perplexing. But as you said, the question and the confusion around these ideas is sometimes its own answer, and the excitement just in not knowing and not understanding. And with music especially, or the arts, culture, creation, is that you don't need to understand it to enjoy it. And the more maybe we could take that mindset into the rest of life would make things hopefully a little less stressful and let people get along a little better. We don't have to understand everybody else or what they do or even what we're supposed to do, as long as we can follow through on that impulse and do it.
Andrew, I have a question for you. Clearly, you create music. This is pretty well documented. I am wondering if you have ever done anything that people would consider as doing magic of any sort. I don't want you to give away anything that's especially personal, but...
I don't know. I mean, I'm doing my best. Do you mean like what? Like what do you mean by magic? Like a magical process to make a song?
For instance, that would be... Yes, that would be good.
Well, I remember I worked at Bergdorf Goodman, which is a department store in Manhattan, right by the Plaza Hotel, by 56th, 57th Street, a real central area there. And a lot of the songs I wrote for my first album, which is called I Get Wet, has that bloody nose on the cover, has that Party Hard song as the main single. I would write those songs while walking around at work doing other stuff. And it's very bizarre because I don't really think of them as... It was more like... you have a flavor in your mouth. You don't know where that flavor came from. And then you're going to find the ingredients out in the world that are somehow able to then either recreate that flavor or enhance that flavor or amplify it. And I don't need to know where it came from. I mean, it probably came from walking around and seeing lots of very beautiful women in the department store and getting to work on mannequins and all kinds of weird stuff. I couldn't really believe I was even in New York, let alone working at Bergdorf Goodman, and wearing an obituary T-shirt almost every day while working there, which did freak out a lot of the customers. Things had to happen, I guess, to keep me energized and enthusiastic about doing the work. And so maybe it was a kind of magic to make up a song, like, I get wet, get wet, get wet, just to keep me moving, you know, just to keep my body moving through the day, because it was a tiring and sometimes otherwise boring job. But, you know, you have something to propel you, to take you further than what you've already done, and music seems like a really reliable power in that way.
There is that. I mean, I'm wondering if you would consider that, on one hand, if you look at what a popular conception of what you would do in magic, which is basically to make something out of nothing, to conjure something that wasn't there before, would that also not serve exactly as a description of what making music is?
Yeah, yeah, especially what I like about music. There's all kinds of music, and that's the beauty of it. The songs that I've made, they're not really so much an expression of an experience that I've gone through or a story, but I love that kind of music too. A lot of people have done it better than I ever could. It really is more to try to summon up a feeling of excitement, of raw energy, not really about expressing even myself, but rather trying to conjure up. I mean, that's the only way I can think of it. And people say oftentimes also that you're supposed to express yourself, but an expression of desire to feel a certain way is just as genuine as expressing a relationship or a trip to the store or whatever you want to sing about. I wanted to make a thing that made me feel better than I otherwise felt, and that's always been enough to motivate me to keep doing it. And hopefully other people feel good, too.
Hmm. I guess I also would wonder if you would consider that basically the effect that music has is something that you would consider being magical, because basically you're sitting here, you've made this thing, you put it into the air, you can't see it, you can't touch it.
Pure experience.
pure experience.
Pure
and
sensation.
It's something that then winds up manifesting in the people who are listening to it.
And it's the greatest
other.
Thing. That's why I feel like it's just the great. It's the future of human civilization, in that right now we already are at this point where you don't really have to own a physical object like a CD to experience that music. You can pull. I mean, my friends and I used to joke about someday you're going to be able to just think of a song and name it, and it'll come down out of thin air, and you can play it. And even beyond that, you can just think of the song.
As long as you own an iPod.
Well, yeah, or some sort of device. You can even just think of a song, though, right? I don't even need to listen to my favorite songs. They're inside my head and sound even better than the recording. You know, I have a very advanced playback system in their surround sound speaker. 30,000 speakers. But, yeah, that idea that here's this industry that's based purely on, you know, images on a screen, lights coming out of a monitor, sound waves coming out of speakers. It's pure experience. And I remember that movie AI that Steven Spielberg made and then Kubrick had been working on. I mean, those advanced life forms, all they really are devices to experience sensation. And I think that's a great, great, great positive step for all of humanity to focus more on that rather than so much material part of the world. And when I say material, I don't mean like leather handbags, because those are pretty cool. There's a lot of great bags out there. Prada's been making a really amazing new design. But that the joy of that bag is the way it feels, you know, and the joy of that bag is thinking about it or talking about it now and laughing, getting something out of it. It's just the experience of life that we really should find the most value in, and not anything other than that.
I'm wondering, does anyone have a question? There's a mic right there, so you could be if you need amplification, there it is. If you want to just shout it out, gentleman back there.
Yeah, I was just wondering, that type of thing, is this going on now?
Are you talking particularly about like the sort of the Jay-Z kind of, you know, Ron? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Eric, could I feel this one?
Sure. He Howard's going
to
take
it. I just wanted to, I mean, coming from what Eric said as to whether it's real or not, there certainly is a cult theory that images and symbols have a power. Just, you know, if you have a phone number, it's a phone number. You can contact someone through it. That's real. It's, you know, even though it's just like a bunch of things are written down on a page. So that basically if you are putting someone's phone number on your album, your CD cover, it's there. For whatever reason you do it, whether you just think that's a cool number, I really dig it. Here's an interesting one. I don't know that anyone will recognize this song, but one of Prince's productions, a band called The Time, they had a song. It was called 777-9311. An interesting sequence of like mystic numbers that would have importance to people, to certain people. You know, was it real, was it not? I mean, the fact is, if you put it out there, it's there, and it does exist, and it does function. If you do it with intention, it's going to be more effective. If you do it without intention, it's going to be more hit and miss. I would propose. I wouldn't know for sure.
Two of the biggest, you know, pop artists or artists have been Beatles and Elvis. And
hello, that's much louder,
thank
isn't
you.
It? That's way louder. Okay, I will stand up from the mic. So Elvis and the Beatles, there's been some evidence with that there have been into occult stuff. Elvis, I know he had a copy of The Secret Teachings of All Ages. And the Beatles
Of which? What did Elvis have?
He had a copy of Manly P. Hall's Secret Teaching of All Ages. And the Beatles have Aleister Crowley and Sri Yukteswar, I think maybe some other people on the Sgt. Pepper cover. So I was just wondering, I mean, a lot of people don't like to talk about it even. Like, especially I know the Rolling Stones, I think, are more into it than they've let on. And particularly, I guess, Elvis and the Beatles haven't talked much about it. But then my other question is kind of about the intersection of Eastern spirituality and people who didn't look to the Western people as much, but like the Doors And there's, you know, there's tons of examples. The Beatles, when they went to the Maharishi. And so that's the other thing, the intersection of the people who, you know, went to more direct to the Eastern source as opposed to the Western magic.
Mm-hmm. I think that the problem with the cover of Sgt. Pepper's is that it's not clear that it wasn't just Peter Blake who made that. I mean, you know, you say, well, but they would, it's an important record. Of course they were going to be having an influence, but even that is kind of hard to pin down. So I think other than George Harrison's interest in, you know, profound interest in Eastern ways, and the deep psychedelia, you know, particularly of John Lennon, with, you know, some connections to magical thinking, it actually is a little hard to do with the Western tradition and the Beatles. But Elvis definitely was into theosophy and more kind of popular currents of it, probably than the kind of a more occult stuff that we're talking about. And then just really quickly, that Indian stuff's really important, but it's kind of a different, it has a very different play, I think, than this esoteric material, but it's obviously incredibly important to the history of popular music. It's just that you kind of need to redefine the term in a way. You know, it's like you can think about it in those terms as well, but like, it's an important difference.
This Jen here has a question. Here comes a mic.
Occultism means hidden. So is it possible that the effect of the magical act is most amplified the more it's unknown? So the reason that the artist may be reluctant to talk about that is that they want it to be effective.
I would say yes, absolutely, without a doubt, personally. I mean, I play like in a small little black metal troupe in New Orleans that... has been most effective because it was small. We wouldn't mention what we were doing, but we knew exactly what we were doing. And I think it works better when it flies under the radar. When people know what they're confronted with, it's easy to put up intellectual bars and be like, oh, well, whatever. When they don't know what they're confronted with, it seeps in the background and is effective on an emotional level and on other levels that perhaps you would otherwise guard against, right, if you were smart.
Does that make this conversation a private conversation?
Does it make it a private conversation? Yes, as a past master once said, let those with ears to hear. So you can say things right out in public that seem very blatant to those who know or want to know, and everyone else just goes like, spooky, which is cool too.
You can yell and you can whisper at the same time.
Yeah.
And if you're going to talk about things like that, I would just like to mention what my own favorite great magical act was of the 20th century. And it was a talisman that was created out of actually a three-album set, something we would now think of as a mixtape. It was made by a magical practitioner named Harry Smith, who in fact gave Kenneth Anger his very first film premiere when Kenneth was just a child. And shortly before he died, which was in the 90s, Harry got a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Grammys. So he shows up at the Grammys. He basically climbs straight on the stage, ignoring the stairs that are right next to him, even though he's a frail old guy. And he comes out and he says, I'm taking this award because I'm glad to say I live to see my dream, the world changed by music. Harry put out the, it was actually Folkways that put out the Anthology of American Folk Music in about 1950. It thereafter became the Bible for the folk revival. Everyone from Dylan on down learn those songs. It affected their idea of what songwriting was. No longer was it how much is that, you know, doggy in the window. It was songs talking about social inequality, about the inner psychological states of what people experienced. And after that, that became songwriting, and that became culture. And then there was revolution in the streets. And even though a lot of that's died down, having lived through that period, it's very hard to not ignore the fact that society was really, really different from 1950 to 2010 in so many ways. And there you go. I think we're all done. Thank you.
You've been listening to Thelema Now and produced with the support of the Ordo Templi Orientis USA Grand Lodge, although the opinions expressed on this program by hosts and guests are theirs alone and do not necessarily represent those of the OTO USA or any of its officers or directors. Our mission here at Thelema Now is to provide listeners with interesting, informative, and thought-provoking interviews featuring people involved in mysticism, spirituality, and magical theory and practice. Until next time, 93.